welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 15th of November 2021, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Once again, it's the beginning of another week, and we are here to discuss the previous week's news, and we have with us today Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How are you doing? It's beautiful over here. Beautiful golden leaves in the trees. It's a lovely time of year. There's all wood smoke in the air. What's it like where you are?
Well, I think that autumn is definitely with us. It's looking a little bit overcast where I am, but it's not too cold. And I always say that you should enjoy the weather and find a way of enjoying the weather, whatever the weather is. And so that way you're not sort of subject to the ups and downs that some people are that only ever appreciate hot sunny weather. If you like cold weather and a crisp morning when you can go out walking and perhaps even feel the frost crunching under your feet, then that's always a good thing in my view.
Britain's beautiful no matter what season it is. Britain is always beautiful, and there's always definition to the seasons as well. It's not like it's just temperate like it is on the elsewhere in the world or on the equator where it's just hot all the time, 12 hours dark, 12 hours light. It's always constantly changing and particularly beautiful, the most beautiful country in the world. And of course it is November, and that means it's the month of Remembrance Day. We had the 11th of November last week at the 11th hour when we had the moment's silence, and we also had Remembrance Sunday yesterday, which I observed the minute silence and pause to just take a think about things and remember all the people that gave their lives fighting for their country, which is what they were fighting for. Of course, we're told today they were fighting to preserve democracy and freedom, and that wasn't what they were fighting for. They were fighting because they thought their country was at risk of being invaded by Germany. It was quite a jingoistic war, really, when you think about it in that way. And the Germans were nationalists, and Britain was pretty much nationalist before this war, but Britain ended up going in the opposite direction, along with the communists, basically. And the biggest tragedy was the millions of people that died. I mean, everybody knows the 6 million number of the supposed number of Jews that died during the war, but most people don't realise the number of everybody else that died during the war, which I heard was about 35 million. Yeah, would that be correct, Max? 35 million, do you think, was the number of people that actually died in total during that war?
What, the Second World War, you think?
Yeah, the Second World War.
Oh, I would think that sort of figure, yes, definitely, perhaps even more than that. If you included, for example, the loss of civilian life there must have been on the Russian front because of the intense fighting that took place there, and the fact that people's homes would have been destroyed and they would have been then left exposed to the elements, but you know, even after the end of the fighting, with the large numbers of German soldiers that were corralled into open fields and kept there for months on end, where quite a lot of them died of typhus and starved to death, and also German civilians who were rounded up and carted off to the salt mines of Siberia by the Soviet Union, and most of whom never came back. So I should think, you know, that sort of figure would be quite on the cards, and perhaps even more.
And we also had the marches, didn't we? We had the Germans that were evicted from lands that they had lived in for centuries in the east of Europe, and they had to just march back to Germany with just the clothes that they had, basically. It was millions of them. It was the largest ethnic cleansing that we've ever had, which doesn't really get talked about. I mean, all these things you remember at this time. You're supposed to specifically remember the soldiers that died, but just the massive amount of death that took place. And when you think it was the real flower of Europe, it was the most noble, the most chivalrous, the most alpha males that we had that went out to war. The ones that stayed at home weren't fit enough to actually fight. So we must have lost pretty much all of our very best stock during that Second War. And of course, at the end of the First World War, they said, well, never again could we have anything like this with so many people dying. We must never go to war again. And yet, thanks to the Versailles Peace Treaty, it was pretty much guaranteed that there was going to be another war on the cards, because they chopped up parts of Germany and gave parts of Germany to other countries with the Germans still in there. So, of course, Germany wanted to get those countries back and wanted to be reunited with their people again. And the countries that had those Germans there didn't want to give up those pieces. And people said at the time, this treaty is pretty much guaranteeing that there is going to be another war. And I do think we're lucky that we haven't had another one since the Second World War. We've got issues at the moment between Belarus and Poland, and Poland are saying that there may be armed intervention here. I hope that there isn't. But when you just think about the numbers of people that we've lost fighting one another as well, I mean, that's what is so scandalous about this. It's brothers fighting brothers. And that was really highlighted, wasn't it, when during the First World War on the Christmas Day, when the guns fell silent and they ended up having a game of football between the Germans and the English. You know, why did they continue after that? Could they not have just realized, yeah, look, we're brothers, you know? And that's where this phrase, no more brothers wars, comes from. Which
I think the ordinary soldiers that actually took part in those football matches, that they would have wondered why they had continued. But I would imagine it would have been the more senior officers that were back from the front that weren't actually involved in the mud and the trenches, etc., and who didn't see firsthand the carnage, who would have imposed military discipline in order to get the soldiers to fight each other again. Yeah, it is very sad that those wars took place. They were dysgenic wars, and there have been lots of people that have spoken. There are quite a few books that have been written about the dysgenic nature, as you say, of both the Second World War and the First World War, in terms of the cream, not just of our manhood, but also of other countries in Europe, France, Germany, etc., who would have been killed on those battlefields. And I always point out that it's noticeable that up until the Second World War, that European countries used to dominate track and field events in the Olympics. And it's notable that almost like the flicking of a switch after the Second World War, it was the Third World countries that tended to dominate, particularly African people of African descent, who tended to dominate the track and field events, and they've tended to do so since, although that is now becoming less and less significant now. But we've lived through a period where the dysgenic effects of those wars is very, very visible on the sports fields of the world. And hopefully we will be able to, in the fullness of time, recover from the loss of those fine people.
I think it's probably the other thing, really. I just say, I think it's probably also apparent in the left-wing nature. Because if you think the people that were left behind, they weren't just the weakest physically, but the weakest mentally as well. And they come out with all these maladaptive ideas, all these progressive liberal ideas. So not just physically that we've been weakened, but just in our outlook and in our mental abilities, our intelligence, our spirit, everything was weakened by it. I just wanted to make that point as well, Max. You wanted to say something as well there.
No, that's okay. And I think one of the things I feel is the saddest is that if you had stopped soldiers during both the Second World War and the First World War and asked them what they were fighting for, and you sort of mentioned this a bit earlier on, most of them would have said that they were fighting to prevent their country from being dominated by a neighbouring country, or to prevent their country from being invaded by a foreign country and having that foreign country's people displacing our own people. And so we have the situation where if you ask these people, they would say that they were fighting to stop their country from being invaded by a foreign nation and having that foreign nation dominate their people and impose its own culture, etc., on them. And yet the after effects of both the First World War and the Second World War have been that our country, Britain, has been so weakened by those wars that we are unable to stop our country from being invaded and from foreign peoples displacing our own people and from the effects of our culture being being displaced and replaced by a culture that's alien to our people. And I think that's very sad. You and I talk about this virtually every day. And so we honour those dead people 365 days of the year. We don't just put a poppy on our collar and honour them for one day a year and pay lip service to the things they fought for. We honour them 365 days of the year and argue that what they fought for should be valued and should be respected, and that in doing that we would be doing what's best for our nation.
Yeah, when you think about it, I mean, there's a thousand people a day, a thousand illegal immigrants a day are turning up on our shores. And I mean, just the numbers themselves, in a year, more turn up than ever appeared during the Norman invasion. So just with the illegal immigrants alone, I think you can quite legitimately liken that to an invasion. And it must feel like that to the people that live on the southeast coast when they see people of a different ethnicity running through their gardens or just landing boats on the beach and running up the beach. I mean, it must be a similar feeling to what the people had when the Normans arrived and ran up the beach. And before that, when the Romans arrived and ran up the beach. Only nowadays, instead of trying to prevent this, we've got our border force going out there and picking them up and aiding them and taking them off to hotels. And as you point out, Max, these people that went to war to fight in the First and the Second World War, it was to preserve our way of life, because they were concerned that one of these other countries would take over and they would have us speak in a foreign language and they would impose their foreign ideas upon us. And today, you know, you go to London and you see all these different languages on the roads there. You see all these different languages when you go to the hospitals, all these different translations, all the sorts of things that we thought that we were actually preserving our country against. And yet the outcome of this war was that we lost all of that. We lost our originality. Are you still there, Max? We had a bit of technical difficulty there.
Well, I'll continue if that's okay. One of the things that I sort of enjoyed when I was watching the remembrance service that was held in Whitehall yesterday was the traditionalism that still prevails at these kind of events. You know, the Wokearty and the Liberals have done their best to try and make these occasions as multicultural as possible by having all sorts of ambassadors from foreign countries, and particularly from the Commonwealth countries, and people from different faiths coming to lay wreaths on the memorial so that it's not seen to be an overwhelmingly white event. The music that was being played by the military bands, though, Royal Britannia, Hearts of Oak, Men of Harlech, Flowers of the Forest, and Elgar's Nimrod were played. And of course, ironically, Beethoven's Funeral March, whilst the wreaths were being laid. And so it is still very traditional in that respect. I did notice, though, that at the British Legion Festival of Remembrance at the Royal Albert Hall earlier on in the week, that the performers that were performing there for the edification of the people that turned up had an overwhelmingly non-traditional British flavour to them. There were more people of immigrant descent there. And the only person that I could see from the reports who sung, who was unqualified white British descent, was Alfie Bow. We even had Gregory Porter, who is sort of black descent, but who always performs dressed like he's out on a coldest winter day you could possibly imagine, which just makes him look ridiculous. And so there he was singing Royal Albert Hall, and everybody else was just wearing lounge suits and dresses for the ladies. But he was stood there singing with an overcoat done up tightly around his neck, with a scarf done up tightly around his neck, and with that sort of silly knitted helmet that's become his trademark on his head. And it just looks so out of place in that kind of an occasion. And I just wonder how long it's going to be before we have a situation where these traditional songs, Rule Britannia, Hearts of Oak, etc., and Elgar's Nimrod, when they're no longer played, when the multicultural element within Remembrance Day is cranked up, as it will be, unless something's done about it to reverse the modern trend, the multicultural content of Remembrance Day will continually be cranked up as the years go by. And I can foresee that we could arrive at a day where Remembrance features hip hop, or features twerking or rap music or something of that sort, which would be absolutely disgraceful in my view. But the sort of thing that I think if somebody predicted it 20 years ago or even 10 years ago, they would have just been laughed at. But nowadays you can see so many things being twisted and changed like that in order to make them more multicultural, which is totally out of place in this kind of context. And it is believable. You could see it happening.
Well, they already tried to do away with Rule Britannia, didn't they, from the proms? And there was a big uproar about that, and they ended up putting it back in there. But yeah, I could definitely see that they would try to add diversity to it and claim that it was white supremacist because it didn't include music by black composers. And of course, then they would have to find some black composers, and then they would say, well, the music itself is racist because there aren't many black composers, so we'll put some hip hop in there. So yes, it is entirely believable. And I did hear that the Royal British Legion advert also had a lot of diversity in it, and didn't feature very many white people. Well, one white person and four people of colour, I think I was told. I heard about this advert, but I didn't actually see it. Did you see this advert at all, Max?
No, I didn't see that.
Oh, you didn't see it either. Well, it seems to be following the same trend as all the television adverts and the Christmas TV adverts as well, where all the white people are just being replaced by black people. The fact of the matter is that there really weren't many non-white people that actually took part in the Second World War, and hardly any that took part in the First World War. And if they did, then they were fighting as paid soldiers, whereas the British people that took part in the war, they were fighting because they were conscripted and they were happy to give their lives for their country, whereas the non-whites came in there because it was a job for them. They were being paid to do this. They were, in effect, mercenaries more than anything else. And they weren't taking part in the front lines. You've talked about this a bit before, haven't you, Max, about the sort of jobs that they were doing. Do you want to elaborate on that a bit?
Yeah, it's very often numbers are quoted, which are quoted in such a way as to give the impression that there were vast numbers of people of perhaps Indian or West Indian extraction who took part in both the First World War and the Second World War, when in reality, because the British Empire still existed in those days, the majority of certainly a very large proportion of the people who volunteered to fight from those parts of the world were the descendants of white families that have gone out there that were colonial administrators, etc. And so the numbers of people who were of non-white extraction who came from the Commonwealth countries to fight on behalf of Britain during both wars was significantly smaller than is alleged. And The other factor to bear in mind as well is that during, particularly during the Second World War, soldiers of Indian extraction were largely used to guard India from invasion by Japan, and so that they weren't actually fighting against our main enemy, which was the Germans during the Second World War. They were fighting in a completely different theatre where there wasn't really a great deal of fighting, and where there was fighting down in Burma and those parts of the of Southeast Asia, it was primarily white British servicemen who were actually fighting the Japanese, and the Indian recruits were largely used for guard duties to guard the rest of India, whilst the colonial the soldiers of that were composed of colonial administrators, the white soldiers from those countries, were preoccupied fighting the Japanese. And during the First World War, there was a contingent of Indian soldiers who were initially put on the Western Front, and some of them did fight very bravely and were awarded medals. Generally speaking, it didn't take very long before it became apparent to the officer corps within the British Army that the Indian soldiers were not suited to fighting in the cold conditions that existed during the winter on the Western Front, and that large numbers of them did actually retreat rather than fight, despite the fact that some of them, as I say, did fight bravely. And the Indian contingents were largely either used in support role, where they were involved in the sort of logistics of getting ammunition, etc., to the front line, or they were transported over to the Middle East and North Africa, where again they were involved in guard duties, largely guarding British colonial towns and cities and centres from any attack that might occur. And largely speaking, there wasn't a lot of fighting that took place outside of Europe during the First World War.
And they were rewarded well. I mean, their countries were rewarded well as well. I mean, it was after the war, we handed the administration of India over to India, and all these other countries as well that were originally a part of the British Empire were handed over to their peoples, that they were considered to be up to a competent enough standard to administrate their own affairs from that moment on. And so we effectively lost this great empire that we had as well, going into this war. And Britain lost its position in the world. We talked about this quite a lot in our series on Enoch Powell and how shocked he was that this had actually happened. So it wasn't just the fact that we lost all these all our very best men, we lost our position in the world, and we lost all our possessions in the world, all the countries in the world that we had. And then we invited them all to come into Britain. I mean, it's really quite a crazy state of affairs the last century, when you look at the way that Britain has behaved and what's gone on. I don't know if you want to add any more to that, Max, or I know you wanted to bring up something about the EU as well, didn't you?
Well, just really to point out that, you know, in having the discussion we've had, we're not trying to denigrate or belittle the bravery of those people from the Commonwealth countries who did come to fight, and who did, in certain instances, fight very bravely on the part of Britain. What we're just trying to make people aware of is that the numbers of these people was much, much smaller than the politically correct sources would try to make us believe nowadays, and to such an extent that they didn't really have a tremendous effect on the course of the war. They had only a marginal effect on the course of the war, rather than them being central to the outcome of both the First World War and the Second World War. Yeah, I mean, as far as talking about sort of struggles between European nations, the subject that I wanted to bring up related to the Northern Ireland Protocol, and it was apparent to me during the time that our exit from the European Union was being negotiated that there was a disproportionate emphasis placed upon the arrangements that were to come into play with regard to Northern Ireland, and that obviously then resulted in the Northern Ireland Protocol being created, which was an arrangement which kind of left Northern Ireland half in and half out of the European Union, which is an unacceptable situation. And I think ideally the British negotiators that were negotiating should not have accepted what was put forward. They did what they did. They signed the Northern Ireland Protocol at the time, but in my view, they signed the Northern Ireland Protocol under duress. And so as any contract which is signed under duress, or as with any contract that's signed under duress, that contract should really be regarded as null and void. And the reason why it should be regarded as null and void is that the European Union's negotiators argued that because of the border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland, and because of the fact that the Northern Ireland, the Good Friday Agreement, the Good Friday Agreement had agreed that there would be no visible border between Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. These two factors were used in order to undermine the British negotiators, and so they agreed to the Northern Ireland Protocol when they shouldn't have done. And
But you could say, I mean, you're saying that it's under duress there, but I mean that the British did sign the Good Friday Agreement. That was the treaty that they had. So is it really fair to say that they were then under duress when they were expected to keep up that treaty?
Well, they were under duress because there was a time limit. So Article 50 of the European Union agreement that specified that the negotiations had to take place within 2 years. And so therefore there was this this strict time limit during which Britain was left in a state of limbo. And of course, you can't have a country and you can't leave your economy in a state of limbo for too long before that starts to have a disastrous effect on you, on your country economically. And so there was duress that was being applied. The European negotiators were deliberately making things as difficult as they possibly could. And it's been said on a number of occasions, both during the time of the negotiations and since, that the terms of Britain's withdrawal from the European Union should make it clear that Britain has been damaged as a result of leaving the European Union, and that should be done as a matter of principle by the European negotiators in order to demonstrate that fact to the people of Europe, so that no other countries will be tempted to follow us out of the European Union. And there was a recent letter that was sent by Emmanuel Macron to Ursula von der Leyen, which in which he included the paragraph, and this was sensationalised to a certain extent in our press, in the Express, for example, where he said, "Il est indispensable." Please excuse my French. Montrer clairement aux opinions publiques européennes que le respect des engagements souscrits n'est pas négociable et qu'il y a davantage de dommages à quitter l'Union que de mourir, which apparently means, because I put it through Google, it says it is essential to make it clear to European public opinion that compliance with the commitments made is non-negotiable and that there is more damage in leaving the Union than in remaining there. And so that basically demonstrates the fact that Macron, the French negotiators, and some of the others who made sort of similar, in some cases more sort of direct statements, that part of their brief was to make sure that the agreement for the withdrawal of Britain from the European Union was penal on Britain. And so you can imagine that even where there were issues which were neither here nor there as far as the European Union was concerned, but where it was known that one aspect of this issue was going to be damaging to Britain, that they would have insisted on that issue being resolved in a way which made it as damaging to Britain as possible, in order for it to be seen that there is more damage to leaving the European Union than staying in. And I think that as far as Northern Ireland is concerned, and the Northern Ireland Protocol, this is a glaring example of that kind of thing, where it didn't really matter to the European Union whether there was a hard border in Ireland or not, and yet they used the fact that they could employ the threat of a renewing of the troubles in Northern Ireland as a means to apply pressure on the British negotiators in order to leave part of Britain half in and half out of the European Union, where they could then continue to allow that that province to become a kind of weeping sore in terms of future negotiations, so that they could always point to Northern Ireland and say, ha, you see, leaving the European Union has damaged Britain far more than if she'd stayed in.
So they were not negotiating in good faith there. And,
absolutely.
And implying that we could have similar troubles like we used to have as a result of this. Yeah, that is pretty scandalous, isn't it? Well, shall we get into our greatest Britons for today then, Max?
Yes, let's do that.
Let's talk some more about Captain Robert Falcon Scott. We've finished the Discovery trip, and at the end of last week's episode, I was wondering what had actually happened to the Discovery, and I found out. After her successful first expedition, due to financial problems, she was sold to the Hudson Bay Company in 1905 and ferried cargoes between London and Hudson Bay, Canada. After sterling service during the First World War and beyond, she was laid up in 1922. In 1923, the Colonial Service refitted her at a huge cost to conduct whaling research as well as oceanographic and hydrological surveys in the Falklands Islands, and from 1929 to 1931, the British government lent her to the British Australian and New Zealand Antarctic Research Expedition. The Discovery was officially handed over to the Boy Scouts on October 9th, 1937, as a training ship for Sea Scouts. And apparently there is actually some film of Lord Baden-Powell at the handover ceremony there. In the 1950s, the Discovery was taken over by the Royal Navy Auxiliary Reserve. And as her condition deteriorated over the years, she was in danger of being scrapped, but was saved by the Maritime Trust in 1979, restored, and finally opened to the public as a museum. Ownership was passed to the Dundee Heritage Trust in 1985, and she was returned to the city where she was built. The Discovery is now the centrepiece of Dundee's visitor attraction Discovery Point. She is displayed in a purpose-built dock in a configuration as near as possible to her 1923 state, and is listed as part of the National Historic Fleet. And she does look absolutely amazing when you actually look at the pictures of her, and I did wonder whether it might make an interesting day out for Patriotic Alternative Scotland to actually go and have a look. Yes. at the Discovery. You know, it's a sort of thing that they would enjoy doing, I think.
Well, or it could be a good day out for any individual that's got some children that they might want to infuse with the derring do of Scott.
Yeah,
I'm
hoping to see the
his team
SS Britannia in the new year. That's in Bristol. That was created by, I've forgotten his name. What was the name of the great engineer? Isambard Kingdom Brunel, the great ship that he created. I'm going to go and have a look at that in the new year. So perhaps someone might like to go and have a look at the Discovery and look at this ship that we've been talking about that was stuck there in the Antarctic for 3 years, and imagine what life was like for Scott and his crew. Well, what we're going to get into today is the start of the Terra Nova expedition, which was between 1910 and 1913. Scott was single and 37 years old when in April 1906 he announced at a Royal Geographical Society meeting that, "I am sorry to say that my lines are cast in such places that in all probability I shall not return to those regions." But there was a great deal of emotion, as in the same speech he touched on those fields of snow sparkling in the sun, the pack ice and bergs and blue sea, and those mountains, those glorious southern mountains rearing their heads in desolate grandeur. the movements of the pack, those small, mysterious movements with the hush sound that comes across the water, and I hear also the swish of the sledge. I cannot explain to you. They will always drag my thoughts back to those good times when these things were before me. Bernacchi wrote years later, those were golden days and the memories are fraught with joy. Michael Barn, with frostbitten fingers, was already trying to raise money to finance his own expedition. Later, in April, Scott was saying that, in all probability, he would return to the Antarctic as London society expected him to make a dash for the pole. In September, Scottish playwright J.M. Barrie wrote to Scott, I chuckle with joy to hear all the old hankerings are coming back to you. I feel you have to go out again, and I too keep an eye open for the man with the dollars. And by early 1907, Scott had made up his mind to lead a second expedition to the Antarctic. And remember, the government themselves thought that they were having far too good a time of it there in the Antarctic, and they actually sent out a rescue expedition, an extra ship to make sure that they came back. So perhaps they weren't that wrong actually, or really is it just that they just have these fond memories because they were doing something new, completely new, and in a completely new world, and they were the first to actually be out there. But at least they had good memories of it. Do you want to comment on any of that, Max?
Well, I think that bleakness. I once spoke to somebody who described the fens of Norfolk as being beautifully bleak, as if bleak was a word that you would use to describe something that was beautiful. And I thought it was quite amusing at the time. I've been to a few bleak places in my time. I've not travelled anywhere near as extensively as Scott did. Never been to the Arctic or the Antarctic, but I did drive across Scotland in the middle of a very cold winter one year. And I can remember driving through the valley leading up to Glencoe and Ballacoolish, which is just on the coast of Scotland, that valley leading up to Glencoe was an incredibly bleak sight, so bleak in fact that it was extremely beautiful. And if I could sort of go back and revisit that again, I would get a great deal of pleasure out of doing that. And so bleakness can be very beautiful.
And the ice is all pristine and clear and shining in the sun, so it is. It must be very, very beautiful out there. Well, on January the 28th, 1907, Scott wrote to the Secretary of the Royal Geographical Society, a Mr. Scott Kelty, requiring financial assistance, £30,000, for a second expedition to Antarctica. He was already in touch with Barn, Mullock and Skelton from the Discovery Expedition, but unfortunately, Ernest Shackleton announced on February the 12th that he was pressing forward with his own plans to lead an expedition to the South Pole. He had already raised £30,000 and he was soliciting the Royal Geographical Society for help as well. Now the RGS felt caught in the middle, which led to a huge rift between Scott and Shackleton that was never to be closed. A Clydebank shipbuilder, William Beardmore, had agreed to guarantee funding for Shackleton with the money to be repaid on Shackleton's return by writing a book, lecturing and selling articles. And Shackleton tried to persuade Mullock to join him, but Mullock declined because he had already committed to Scott. This caught Shackleton by surprise, as he had no idea that Scott was planning on a return expedition. Dr. Wilson was also approached by Shackleton, but likewise declined as he was in the middle of an exhaustive project concerning his bird research in Antarctica, and it just wouldn't be appropriate to abandon his studies at this time. The day after Wilson received the request from Shackleton, a letter showed up from Scott, in which he was curious if Shackleton had mentioned his own desire to return to McMurdo Sound. This was the first that Wilson had heard of Scott's plans. And this reminds me that Shackleton did have quite a few harebrained schemes for trying to make money. He's obviously desperate to get back out there, and he's sort of mortgaging the trip already by saying he's going to do all these things when he comes back, and he's just desperate to get out there again. And of course this is causing problems because it's Scott's baby. Basically, Scott was clearly upset for essentially one basic reason. the view that an explorer may have an exclusive right to his own territory was an unspoken given. As the Frenchman Jean Charcot said, there can be no doubt that the best way to the pole is by way of the Great Ice Barrier. But this we regard as belonging to the English explorers, and I do not propose to trespass on other people's grounds. Shackleton had announced that he intended to make his winter quarters at McMurdo Sound, an announcement that should have been respectfully cleared through Scott first, but the courtesy was never extended to his former commander. Nevertheless, Scott made an effort not to let his personal feelings stand in his way, as he wrote to Scott Kelty on March the 1st and told him, "It is our duty to work together as Englishmen. I mean you, I, and Shackleton, and all concerned. The first thing is to defeat the foreigners. Whether Shackleton goes, or I go, or we both go, we must let Arctowski clearly understand that the Ross Sea area is England's, and we will not appreciate designs upon it." On the other hand, Dr. Wilson wrote to Shackleton, "I think that if you go to McMurdo Sound and even reach the pole, the guilt will be off the gingerbread, because of the insinuation which will almost certainly appear in the minds of a good many that you forestalled Scott, who had a prior claim on the use of that base." Shackleton and Scott met in London on May 17, 1907, where Shackleton put into writing that he was to leave McMurdo Sound base to you and land either at the place known as the Barrier Inlet or at King Edward VII Land, whichever is the most suitable. If I land at either of those places, I will not work to the westward of the 170 meridian west and shall not make any sledge journey going west. I think this outlines my plan, which I shall rigidly adhere to, and I hope this letter meets you on the points that you desire. Scott replied, "Your letter is a very clear statement of the arrangement to which we came. If, as you say, you will rigidly adhere to it, I do not think our plans will clash." Shackleton bought a small dilapidated sealer, the Nimrod, and attracted two former mates from the Discovery expedition to join him, Frank Wild and Ernest Joyce, and the Nimrod sailed from the East India docks on July 30th, 1907, taking a motor car with it, the first to be landed in Antarctica. And obviously the story of Shackleton we have already covered. I find it interesting here, there's this gentleman's agreement that you don't go exploring in the area that somebody else has already laid a claim to and gone exploring.
Yeah, I think they resolved that there in a fairly gentlemanly way, which is good, because it could have been a very big issue between the two of them. But I think that it's understandable that Shackleton would have made his own arrangements, because Scott had so clearly stated that he would probably not return to the Antarctic again. And so that could be taken as Scott, by implication, stating that he had no issue with somebody else trying to get to the South Pole the same way. So you can see that on the one hand, Shackleton, you know, perhaps should have determined the situation by directly asking Scott. But on the other hand, Scott had, by implication, stated that he wasn't interested at one point in going back. And so you can see why the disagreement grew up. But it would appear that they have resolved the issue with this meeting in London. And that's the best outcome, I suppose.
Yeah, and in the face of this threat of the foreigners getting there first. And that's interesting. Absolutely. As well. I mean, that they've got this rivalry between them, but that will be forgotten in the face of, well, we've got to beat our white brothers over there to get there first. So there was basically a race to get there between a lot of different countries at the time. Well, Scott went back to sea as captain of HMS Albemarle, a battleship with a complement of over 700 men. His appointment ended on August 25th, 1907, and Scott went on half pay until his next appointment on January 1st, 1908 to HMS Essex. And it was between these appointments that Scott met, for the second time, a 28-year-old sculptor, Kathleen Bruce. The two were invited to tea at Mabel Beardsley's, where Kathleen was struck by Scott's rare smile. Scott was hooked, and for the next 10 days he either visited with her or wrote love notes. "Uncontrollable footsteps carried me along the embankment to find no light. Yet I knew you were there, dear heart. I saw the open window, and in fancy a sweetly tangled head of hair upon the pillow within. Dear head, it seems so long till Friday. Give me all the time you can. By the end of November, the two were engaged to be married. Although Scott felt he owed his mother his allegiance, Hannah wrote that you must never let me be a hindrance to your making a home and a life of your own. You have carried the burden of the family since 1894. It is time now for you to think of yourself and your future. May God bless and keep you. And it's quite an old age, isn't it, to be getting married at this time, 37 years of age. And I guess where he's been carrying his family all this time and paying out all his money to look after his family, and sort of missed out on going out with the lads, and then also all that time spent in the Antarctic. Well, meanwhile, Shackleton and the crew of the Nimrod could not penetrate the ice pack to reach King Edward the Seventh Land, so they had to turn back and land the explorers' party at McMurdo Sound. This broke his promise to Scott, and as the Nimrod steamed westwards, Shackleton wrote to his wife, "I have been through a sort of hell since the 23rd of January, and I cannot even now realise that I am on the way back to McMurdo Sound, and that all idea of wintering on the barrier at King Edward Seventh Land is at an end, that I have had to break my word to Scott and go back to the old base, and that all my plans and ideas have now to be changed by the overwhelming forces of nature. I never knew what it was to make such a decision as the one I was forced to make last night." Scott, however, felt that this was Shackleton's intention from the very beginning, and he thus felt further betrayed. And this is the point. I mean, Shackleton set up this trip wanting to go to McMurdo Sound, and really it was unfeasible for him to do the trip going anywhere else. I think we learned that when we did the episode on him, that it was a bit of a harebrained scheme to think that he was going to be able to go to any of these other places. You know, you have to think of what's there, and nature is going to prevent you from going in these other routes. That's the reason why Scott went to McMurdo Sound in the first place, is because that was the only route that could really be taken. So for Shackleton to say he's going to take another route, and I mean, that really sort of messed everything up as well for him, didn't it? Because you're going to have to turn back, and you've only got enough supplies, and really everything started going wrong for Shackleton after that, didn't it?
So perhaps the honourable way out for Shackleton would have been to have offered his services to Scott and offered the equipment and men that he'd taken down to the Antarctic to Scott and put them at Scott's disposal as part of the Scott expedition. And so effectively joined Scott's expedition. I think would have been the honourable way of settling that. And then both sides could have been, well, obviously Shackleton wouldn't have been happy that he would have lost his own independent expedition, but he could still have secured a tremendous amount of glory by joining Scott.
Yeah, that would have been the honourable thing to do, I think. Great shame that they didn't do that. Well, Con and Kathleen's courtship continued into 1908. Although he never mentioned any attempt at the pole, Kathleen wrote to Con in July 1908 asking him to write and tell me that you shall go to the pole. Oh dear me, what's the use of having energy and enterprise if a little thing like that can't be done? It's got to be done, so hurry up and don't leave a stone unturned, and love me more and more because I need it. Finally, on September the 2nd, 1908, Con and Kathleen were married in the Chapel Royal at Hampton Court. I think she doesn't really understand quite what's going to be going on there, because he's going to be gone for years. And do you just see what I mean?
That's right. She thinks he's just popping to the shops.
Yeah. Well, a sailor's wife in those days was one to be pitied, as husbands were generally at sea for perhaps 90% of their married life. The wife was left to maintain the home and care for the children, while the husband was away at sea, presumably having a gay old time with his fellow sailors and a wife in every port. This was a popular theory, but in this case the opposite were true. Kathleen was living it up in London with all her friends, while making a name for herself as a sculptor. Meanwhile, Con was living a lonely life as captain aboard the HMS Bulwark. So perhaps she was a bit of a feminist as well. But Kathleen had her moments too, as she wrote to Conn in November 1908, telling him she was as desperately, deeply, violently, and wholly in love as he was, and was missing him terribly. "There's something so terribly real about you. I used to mend your trouser placket hole, and there's something grotesquely real about that. I never used to know anything about loneliness. Sir, have you robbed me of my self-sufficiency?" Early in 1909, good news finally arrived. Kathleen wrote, "My love, my dear love, my very dear love, throw up your cap and shout and sing triumphantly, for it seems we are in a fair way to achieve my aim. Kathleen was pregnant." Also, an opportunity arose for Conn to spend 9 months living at home with his wife as an ordinary human. A position as naval assistant to Admiral Sir Francis Bridgman was offered and accepted at the end of March 1909. So he did get a chance to have some family life, even if it was just 9 months there. And now we get some news from Shackleton. Also in March 1909, the news came that Shackleton had not reached the pole. Despite all the hardships, Shackleton, Adams, Marshall and Wild had crossed the barrier, struggled up the glacier, which Shackleton named after his patron, Mr. Beardmore, and planted the flag at 88 degrees 23 minutes south, some 97 miles from the pole. Meanwhile, Professor Edgeworth David, Scott's surgeon A.F. Mackey and Douglas Mawson pushed on beyond the point reached by Scott on his western journey in 1903 and planted a flag on the South Magnetic Pole. On July 1st, 1909, Scott wrote to Shackleton, "If, as I understand, it does not cut across any plans of your own, I propose to organise the expedition to the Ross Sea, which, as you know, I have had so long in preparation so as to start next year. I am sure you will wish me success, but of course I should be glad to have your assurance that I am not disconcerting any plans of your own." Shackleton replied that his plans will not interfere with any plans of mine, and on September 13, 1909, Scott announced his plans. "The main object of the expedition is to reach the South Pole and secure for the British Empire the honour of that achievement." That very same day, a son, Peter, was born to Kathleen and Conn. James Berry, a personal friend and the Scots playwright who wrote Peter Pan as well as Clements Markham, were chosen as the godfathers. And of course, Clements Markham was the financier or the organiser of that first expedition, wasn't it? It was only a chance meeting with Clements Markham that actually led to all of this. On April 6, 1909, Robert Edwin Peary, a 56-year-old commander on leave from the US Navy, together with Matthew Henson, his Negro servant and companion, reached the North Pole on their sixth attempt. The North was won, so all thoughts of polar exploration now turned towards the South. Several nations now commenced with preparations for the trek. Peary announced in New York his plans to form an Antarctic expedition, with the goal of the pole attained by embarking from a region within the Weddell Sea. Germany's Lieutenant Wilhelm Filchner announced similar plans as the Americans, but with the added goal of being the first to march right across the pole in a trans-Antarctic expedition ending in McMurdo Sound. Frenchman Jean-Baptiste Charcot was exploring regions in Graham Land. The Japanese, led by Lieutenant Nobu Shirase, planned an expedition to the very region which Scott had hoped to explore in King Edward VII Land. So the race is really on now. Scott went to work to raise the needed £40,000 for the expedition, but unfortunately donations were slow in coming. Sir Edgar Speer, the city financier, became honorary treasurer of the British Antarctic Expeditions Fund and donated £1,000. Touring the countryside, giving lectures to unenthusiastic audiences, Scott spent many cold nights in cheap hotel rooms. Between £20 and £30 from Wolverhampton, £40 today, nothing from Wales. This place won't do. I'm wasting my time to some extent. I don't think there is a great deal of money in the neighbourhood. Things have been so-so here. I spoke not well, but the room was beastly and attendance small. Another very poor day yesterday, nearly everyone out, Scott wrote. But £2,000 came from Manchester, £1,387 from Cardiff, and 750 from Bristol. In November 1909, Shackleton got the knighthood that Scott had missed, and his book, The Heart of the Antarctic, was published. So Scott must be feeling quite down about this. You know, yeah. It's his baby getting out there, and he's got all these others that have announced they're on their way out there, and he's struggling to get the money together, and hardly anyone's actually coming to see him when he goes to speak. In January 1910, the government announced a grant of £20,000, and now the expedition could buy a ship. Scott wanted the Discovery, but the Hudson's Bay Company refused to sell her. After considering several others, Scott purchased the Terra Nova for a down payment of £5,000, with the promise of an additional £7,500 when the funds could be raised. Experiments with motor sledges were now underway. Michael Barn, still dealing with frostbitten hands from the Discovery expedition, had designed a new sledge. Barn declined the opportunity to join Scott and was married just before the departure of the Terra Nova. Early in March 1910, Scott went to Norway with Kathleen, Reginald Skelton, two mechanics and a motor expert, Bernard Day, to test the experimental sledges. While in Christiania, Nansen introduced an expert skier, Trygve Gran, to them. Gran was planning his own assault on the pole, but dropped his plans and joined Scott. Lieutenant Teddy Evans, who had talked his way into his appointment in the morning, had started to raise funds for yet another expedition to the pole, but when he heard of Scott's plans, he agreed to abandon his personal desires and join forces with Scott, provided he was offered the position of second in command. Although Skelton was deeply hurt, Scott could not refuse the offer, as the funds raised by Evans would be a real windfall. Evans was given the charge of getting the ship prepared for the south, which was quite a task, as upon her return from the Discovery expedition, the Terra Nova had been used for whaling and sealing and was now in a filthy, stinking condition. And you don't imagine all these problems that they have to get all this going. You know, they've got to fix the ship. They've got to raise the money. It's so different to today, isn't it? When you think of a scientific expedition and it's just paid for and it's set up from our taxes and the government funds it. I mean, this is so different back then, isn't it?
Well, I think I mentioned with regard to Ranulph Fiennes that he described a similar sort of process for himself. So I don't think that all modern day explorers get it sort of handed to them on a plate. You know, he worked for 10 years to raise enough money for one of his Antarctic expeditions. And so, you know, it was the same for Scott.
It was all for the glory of the British Empire, though, as well. I mean, it's all to be the first ones out there to beat Johnny Foreigner. And, you know, it's just out of a sense of we need to be the first ones out there. The English need to be the first ones out there, the British.
Shows how patriotism is driving people, yeah. Wasn't it, in their daily lives.
Totally the driving force behind all of this. I think we should probably leave it there, Max, and we'll get into picking up the crew next week, unless there's anything else that you want to add or any thoughts about this you want to bring up.
No, I think that's fine. I think it's a suitable place to pause.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
That's been good.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Monday with more Real Britannia for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.